Okay, let's dive in. We are about to really unpack the work of a filmmaker who sees history, well, not as something finished, but as this like active force demanding our attention. Mm-hmm. We're focusing today on Raoul Peck. I mean, this is somebody who was a student in Berlin, drove a taxi in New York City, and served as Haiti's Minister of Culture.
Yeah, all before creating some of the most powerful political films out there.
It's quite the background.
It absolutely is. And for anyone looking for, you know, a way into understanding the key figures in modern political cinema, Peck is essential. Our mission here is to pull together a pretty rich set of sources.
Right.
Sources covering his political life, which was very principled, his own production company, Velvet Film. And of course, these major works like Lumumba, I Am Not Your Negro, Exterminate All the Brutes.
And the goal is to see how his own life story, which is so fragmented geographically.
Haiti, Congo, Europe, the U.S.
Exactly. How that doesn't just influence his art, but it's like the very fabric of it.
Yeah, it is the raw material. It's built from that experience.
Oh, and what comes through really clearly from the sources is that Peck is deeply politically engaged. He's just not interested in finding some sort of neutral middle ground.
No, not at all. He uses history, politics, very personal memories to tackle these big societal problems. And he's always making that link, isn't he? Connecting historical suffering to what's happening right now.
Mm.
So the key thing, I think, for you, the listener, to grasp right at the start is this. Peck's films are a direct challenge. They challenge the power structures that usually control who gets to tell the story.
Okay.
Because he lived under Duvalier in Haiti, he saw the fragility of post-colonial Congo firsthand, then studied capitalism in Europe. His work is designed to expose those connections, you know, between historical violence and how wealth is distributed today.
So he's not just showing history, he's sort of arguing with it.
Exactly. Arguing with it, using his own global life as the evidence.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning then, because to really get the global reach of his films,
yeah,
you also have to map out his life journey. Born in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, 1953, and his early life was just dominated by the political situation there.
Totally shaped by it. The Duvalier dictatorship arrives, and when Peck is just 8 years old, 1961, his family flees.
They had to get out.
Yeah. But they didn't just go next door. They ended up joining his father in what was then Leopoldville, soon to be Kinshasa in the Congo, the DRC.
Which had just gained independence.
Lost a very volatile time.
And this part is so crucial, often maybe skipped over. He wasn't just a Haitian kid in exile. He spent 24 years growing up in the Congo.
24 years. Think about that. His father was an agronomist working for the UN, the FAO, UNESCO.
Part of that international effort after independence.
Right. Teaching agriculture, helping set up infrastructure after the Belgians left so abruptly.
So Peck is watching literally a nation trek to build itself.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, struggling immensely in the process.
He's immersed in it.
Yeah.
His father's part of the UN mission trying to build structures. His mother, Giselle, she worked as an aide, a secretary for mayors in Kinshasa for years. So he's seeing not just the culture, but the actual messy bureaucracy of a post-colonial state up close.
You get this incredible tension then, the trauma of Haiti's dictatorship hanging over him. But he's living in Kinshasa, which was this hub, right? International aid, political ideals floating around.
Yeah, but also chaos.
And this is just months after Patrice Lumumba was assassinated.
Shh.
That environment had to politicize him from day one.
Oh, absolutely. It had to. And his journey didn't stop there. His education path is, well, surprisingly practical for someone who ends up an artist.
Schools in Kinshasa, then Brooklyn.
Brooklyn, New York.
Then Orléans, France. Before finally settling on his main studies.
Which were, and this is fascinating, industrial engineering and economics at Humboldt University in Berlin.
Wait, economics? Before film school, he's studying the mechanics of industry, the flow of capital.
Exactly. For someone with, you know, artistic dreams, as the sources put it, it seems like a detour.
A massive one.
But Peck saw that European structural education as vital. Non-negotiable. He actually said he had to educate himself as much as possible before he could even think about a film career back in Haiti or anywhere else.
He needed the tools.
The analytical framework. He needed economics to really pick apart the global systems he saw causing so much damage in Haiti in the DRC.
That makes sense. He didn't just want to tell stories. He wanted to build a case.
Yeah.
An evidenced argument.
Precisely. Not a casual observer, but an informed critic, someone who understood the structures.
Okay, so that rigorous background sets up his transition in the 80s, before he gets his film degree in 88 from the DFFB in Berlin.
The German Film and Television Academy.
Right. He does some really practical kind of ground level jobs.
Yeah, like driving a taxi in New York City for a year.
Which, after studying global economics in Berlin, must have been quite the experience.
Talk about seeing theory meet reality. Poverty, racism, inequality, right there in the rearview mirror.
And he was also working as a journalist and a photographer from about 1980 to 85.
Right. So, taxi driver, journalist, photographer, these jobs put him right in contact with people, training his eye, you know, to see social reality directly, practical extensions of his studies.
And he secured his independence early. He founded his own production company, Velvet Film, mm-hmm. in Germany in 1986, while still studying film.
Still a student. That tells you everything about his intention. He knew he needed control.
Yeah.
And Velvet Film became the engine. It produced or co-produced pretty much everything he did afterwards. Docs, features, TV. He knew early on, if you want to tell difficult stories, especially from a non-Western viewpoint, you can't rely on the established studios.
We've got to build it yourself.
You have to build your own machine.
And he didn't just build it for himself. He invested back home in Haiti, founding the El Dorado Forum in Port-au-Prince in 95.
Right, specifically to help local Haitian artists, to support their creativity, give them resources.
He's an infrastructure builder, trying to make sure the next generation had the local support he had to find internationally.
And that sense of responsibility, building infrastructure, it leads directly into the next really unique phase of his life, when he actually stopped filming politics for a bit.
And started doing politics.
Exactly.
Becoming Haiti's Minister of Culture, that's a major shift. March 96 to October 97, under Prime Minister Rosny Smarth. Short tenure, but wow.
A very principled decision, you know, to step away from filmmaking and into the actual administration of this fragile nation trying to recover from dictatorship.
But it didn't last long, because his principles, it seems, were more important than staying in power.
Completely. He resigned. Along with the prime minister and five other ministers, it was a direct protest against Presidents Préval and Aristide.
Not a quiet exit. A clean break based on ethics.
Yeah, he wasn't going to compromise on that. And it was such a defining moment. He wrote a whole book about it, Monsieur le Ministre. Jusqu'au bout de la patience.
Mr. Minister.
Yeah.
To the end of patience.
Right. And reviews of the book called it a portrait of a formidable democratic movement. He didn't just quit. He documented that struggle for real, uncorrupted democracy.
And you can see that same uncompromising political drive in his very early films, even before he officially graduated film school.
Oh, yeah. His first short in 1982, The Cuba Trago Un Cantar. It was about a Cuban music group visiting West Berlin for a peace concert. Political right away.
Then Lubed in 83. Focusing on protests during Reagan's visit to Berlin, directly engaging with Cold War tensions.
And Merry Christmas Deutschland in 84, a report about, like, history lessons taught on Christmas Day in Helmut Kohl's Germany. He was already finding politics in the everyday.
Using concerts, street protests, even Christmas lessons to show the political currents underneath.
That early work, that direct commentary, it really set him up for returning to Haitian themes in his features. His first feature film, Haitian Corner, 1987, shot while he was still a student.
And it deals directly with the legacy of Duvalier's terror.
Yeah, it follows a Haitian man in exile in New York. He'd been tortured by the Tanis Makuts.
Duvalier's secret police. Notorious.
Right, and the whole film hinges on this moment where he runs into his former torturer. Does he seek revenge or find a way to forgive?
So not a simple revenge plot. It's about the moral weight of trauma.
Exactly. Interrogating how that violence continues to define a survivor's life, even in exile, that became his style. Big political violence filtered through intimate moral choices.
He followed that with The Man by the Shore in 1993, L'Homme Silique.
Which was huge, a fictional story, but it traces the very start of Duvalierism, the beginning of the terror, all seen through the eyes of an 8-year-old girl, Sarah.
Innocent eyes watching this darkness descend.
And critically, this film was a big deal. Nominated for the Palme d'Or at Cannes, that put him on the global map.
And it was the first Haitian film released in U.S. theaters.
Yeah, which was massive for representation. It showed that Haiti's complex, difficult history could actually reach a mainstream Western audience.
So this mix of personal stories and sharp political insight started getting him recognition beyond festivals. Human Rights Watch gave him the Nestor Almendros Prize in 1994.
And the Irene Diamond Award in 2000. both for his human rights work through film. He established himself early as this really essential, uncompromising voice.
And that uncompromising stance was about to be seriously tested when he decided to tackle the story of Patrice Lumumba.
Oh, the Lumumba Project. Yeah, that's a perfect example of the kind of resistance he faced.
The structural barriers in funding these kinds of stories.
Totally. He really struggled at first to get a fiction film about Lumumba off the ground. Lumumba, you know, the father of Congo's independence, a national hero.
But the money people weren't interested.
The investors, mostly European and American, they wanted a story centered on a European character. The usual suspects, the diplomat, the journalist.
A white witness, someone relatable for the perceived audience.
Exactly. They wanted to make the history, you know, digestible, palatable. But Peck was absolutely set on telling it from Lumumba's perspective, a full, complex portrait of the black hero.
And refusing to compromise meant
years of struggle, financial headaches. Many filmmakers just couldn't have sustained that fight.
So how did he get around it?
He took a different route first. He went personal, used his own background, his own production company, and made a documentary.
Lumumba, Death of a Prophet in 1991.
Right. And he stressed how personal this was. He found old family photos, 8mm films his own dad shot when they were living in the Congo during that exact period.
Wow. So the documentary wasn't just history, it was reclaiming his own past, too.
Yeah, it was grounding the story in his lived experience. He said the documentary and the later feature film were really two different things for him, the doc being about his personal connection to the Congo.
And making the documentary first maybe helped build the case for the feature.
It absolutely provided the groundwork, the credibility. So then, finally, in 2000, he could make the feature film Lumumba, designed to be more accessible, telling that pivotal story around Congolese independence in 1960.
And the sources say it unveiled unwritten controversial history. History often swept under the rug in Western accounts.
Definitely. And it worked. Won Best Feature at two big African film festivals, got great reviews. It was the full-on confrontation with Lumumba's story that he'd wanted all along.
The success of Lumumba must have opened some doors. It led to an HBO commission, right?
Mm.
Tackling another huge African tragedy.
Yeah, the Rwandan genocide. In 2005, HBO commissioned Sometimes in April,
an English-language TV movie starring Idris Elba, focusing on the 1994 massacre. 800,000 people killed. That's taking on an incredibly heavy, sensitive subject with a major American studio.
Huge. And this is where Peck's insistence on ethical filmmaking really came to the fore. He laid down conditions to HBO that he later said were basically unacceptable by industry standards.
Okay, what were these demands?
First, the story had to be told entirely from the Rwandan point of view. No Western character as the audiences weigh in.
Right.
Second, he insisted on shooting the entire film in Rwanda.
On location, where the genocide happened. That must have been incredibly difficult, logistically, emotionally.
Immense challenges. Security, insurance, the sensitivity of filming recent trauma on site. But he wouldn't budge.
And HBO.
Agreed. Amazingly, yeah. They accepted all his conditions. His commitment to getting it right was intense. He studied reports, testimonies.
Yeah.
He said every single line is authentic and based on facts.
Not historical fiction, but dramatized fact.
Exactly. And the premiere itself showed that commitment. It wasn't in L.A. or New York. The Rwandan people saw it first in the arena in Kigali.
He prioritized the community affected.
Above everything else. And that dedication was recognized. It won TV Program of the Year at the AFI Awards, Best Film at Durban. It proved that sticking to your principles, demanding authenticity, doesn't kill a project. It can make it more powerful.
So after these deep dives into African history, Peck takes that same rigorous, non-compromising approach and turns it towards these big global ideologies, starting with race in America.
Which leads us to, what has to be one of the most important documentaries of the last decade, I Am Not Your Negro from 2016.
Based on James Baldwin's unfinished book, Remember This House.
Right. Baldwin's project was going to be about his friends, Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, their lives, their assassinations.
And just getting the rights took Peck. How long?
About 10 years. Just to get permission to use Baldwin's estate, his letters, his words. Think about that dedication.
Incredible patience.
And the film itself, narrated by Samuel L. Jackson, it's just masterfully constructed.
Right.
It uses Baldwin's actual words from letters, speeches, the manuscript woven with archival footage. It charts the history of racism, the constant oppression of Black Americans.
And the genius is using Baldwin's unfinished work to say that this history is also unfinished.
Right.
Exactly. It connects the 1960s footage directly to images from today, showing how Baldwin's insights are just timeless, tragically relevant.
The critical response was huge.
Universal acclaim, like 99% on Rotten Tomatoes, 96 on Metacritic. Oscar nomination, won the Caesar, won an Emmy. It really changed the game for how documentaries can use archival material and powerful language to interrogate history and power.
But Pick doesn't just stay on one topic. The very next year, 2017, he pivots again intellectually. He makes The Young Karl Marx.
Yeah, from Baldwin and American race relations to the origins of the Communist Manifesto, it seems like a big leap.
But is it?
Well, the common thread is still there, isn't it? Understanding how systems of power are built, how exploitation gets theorized, justified.
And Peck himself said Marx was huge for him during his own education in Berlin back in the 70s and 80s.
Right. He said understanding Marx's analysis was key to confronting the past and the present. It connects back to his economics degree.
But filming the evolution of an idea? That sounds tough.
He said it was the hardest script he ever worked on. Took 10 years with his screenwriter, Pascal Bonitzer. How do you make the development of political thought dramatic, cinematic, without dumbing it down?
Yeah, that's a challenge.
And the film makes a point of including the collaborators often left out of the story. Jenny Marx, Karl's wife, helping with the manifesto draft. Mary Burns, Engels' partner, mediating their debates, showing the whole intellectual ecosystem.
That structural critique then expands even further in 2021 with the HBO series Exterminate All the Brutes.
A huge four-part documentary won a Peabody Award. And this one really digs into the genocidal core of European colonialism.
And he's synthesizing multiple major academic works here.
Yeah, it's not just one source. He pulls from Sven Lindqvist's book, Exterminate All the Brutes, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz's An Indigenous People's History of the United States, and Michelle Rolfe Triot's crucial work, Silencing the Past.
It's a scholarly foundation for a powerful argument.
And Peck narrates it himself, making it very direct. His argument is intentionally provocative, that white supremacy and the impulse to eliminate the other weren't side effects of colonialism, they were central to it, the ideological engine.
Leading to global exterminations.
Exactly. He calls it a story of survival and violence, using archival footage, new material, even animation to depict things that couldn't be filmed.
This series feels like his most explicit statement of philosophy.
Yeah.
That line from the trailer, neutrality is not an option. The past has a future we never expect.
That really sums up his whole approach, doesn't it? History isn't dead. It's active. It shapes our future.
And we should connect this back to his early studies, too, the economics.
Yeah.
His critique isn't just political, it's financial.
Definitely. Back in 2001, he did a film for Arte called Profit and Nothing But, part of a series called La Bourse et la Vie.
The stock market and life.
Right. And his film focused specifically on the devastating impact of predatory capitalism on his home country, Haiti.
So it all connects. The trauma in Haiti, the struggles in Congo, the critique of race in America, the roots of Marxism, the violence of colonialism.
Yeah.
It's all part of one big analysis of global power structures.
It's one continuous, interconnected argument unfolding across his entire career.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about the content, the politics.
Right.
But how does he actually do it?
Yes.
How does he weave all these complex threads, history, politics, personal memory, into films that aren't just, you know, academic essays?
Yeah. The how is key. It's his style. The sources point out that his films often use the polish and, like, the structural effectiveness of American cinema.
They look good. They're well-paced.
Or, right, they draw you in. But then he combines that accessibility with these really complex, non-linear techniques.
Like a collage, you said.
Exactly. He breaks up the timeline, uses flashbacks, flash-forwards, what the sources call time overlay, so history feels like it's happening right now, bleeding into the present.
Showing the legacy directly.
And the voiceover is crucial, too. It's always shifting. Sometimes it's Peck himself, like in Exterminate. Sometimes it's Baldwin's words in I Am Not Your Negro. Sometimes it's another character or observer.
So it's never just one single authoritative voice telling you what to think.
Right. That multiplicity avoids it becoming a lecture. It's this mixed documentary footage, animation, different voices, fractured timelines that allows him to blend the politics, the history, the poetry, and the deeply personal stuff organically.
They're not just watching. You're kind of piecing it together with him.
You're actively participating in understanding this fragmented reality.
And this whole complex style serves a very clear purpose. He's been blunt about it.
Yeah.
He's not primarily aiming for entertainment.
Not at all. He said he got into film because of politics, because of content, not because I wanted to make Hollywood films.
Which is pretty different from a lot of the film industry.
Yeah, he contrasts his approach with American cinema, which he says often claims that its purpose is entertainment and aims to please the audience, not so much to provoke.
Peck wants to provoke.
He wants to change how you see history, make you feel the cost of it, and crucially, provoke a reaction, make you think critically.
That kind of intellectual filmmaking demands really intense work in the writing stage. He's talked about how hard that is.
Finding a writing partner who gets it, who shares that philosophical or political grounding, he said it's incredibly difficult.
Which makes his long collaboration with Pascal Bonitzer on the Young Karl Marx even more significant.
10 years. They needed that time and that shared understanding to turn dense theory into something dramatic and watchable.
And he continues these kinds of deep collaborations. He's mentioned ongoing projects with the writer Russell Banks.
Who's a major figure himself. Banks even wrote the preface for Peck's book about his time as Minister of Culture. That shows a deep intellectual trust.
Choosing partners who share that uncompromising political lens.
Absolutely. And Peck, I mean, he's still incredibly productive after decades in the business. His recent work keeps hitting these core themes.
Like Silver Dollar Road last year for Amazon, about a black family fighting developers trying to take their land.
Right back to that intersection of race, land, and capitalist pressure, the personal impact of systemic forces.
And just this year, 2024, he premiered Ernest Cole, Lost and Found at Cannes, about the South African photographer.
Bringing him back to Southern Africa, back to post-colonial critique through the lens of art and resistance.
And he's got two huge documentary projects in the works right now, both incredibly timely and political.
The first is about the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse in 2021.
Which brings him right back to Haiti. Its instability, the questions of power and interference there, full circle.
And the second one, which is maybe the most intriguing philosophically, is Orwell, a documentary about George Orwell for Neon.
Orwell. Given Peck's focus on power, truth, history, surveillance, applying his style to Orwell seems potentially explosive.
Yeah, imagining Peck's collage technique tackling the author of 1984, it promises a really potent look at modern authoritarianism, information control.
Okay, so let's try to pull this all together. If we synthesize everything we've looked at, what's the main thread in Raoul Peck's career?
I think the core, the constant, is this unwavering commitment to telling history from the perspective of those who usually don't get to tell it. The oppressed, the marginalized.
He's like a guide, using film to force us to confront uncomfortable truths.
Absolutely. Using nonlinear stories, archival evidence, his own personal history to just shatter our easy assumptions about how the world works.
And for you, the listener, his films are this incredibly direct, deeply researched way into understanding some of the most critical moments and issues in modern global history.
Yeah, whether it's Rwanda or Haiti under Duvalier or race in America through Baldwin or even the ideas of Karl Marx, he's always digging for the why. Why are things structured the way they are? And it's often not comfortable to look at.
He makes it very clear with his statement. Neutrality is not an option.
Yeah.
Especially when dealing with systemic problems.
Exactly. Which brings us to that final thought. He's now turning his attention to George Orwell, the ultimate writer about totalitarianism, surveillance, the manipulation of truth.
So the question becomes, how will Peck, with his unique style and his fierce commitment to exposing power, interpret Orwell for our time?
What new parallels might he draw between the dangers Orwell warned about and, say, the systems of global capitalism or digital surveillance today, that Orwell film? It feels like it could be a major statement about the future Peck sees us heading towards. What history is he going to force us to confront next?